From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There is a big red circle on Thursday on this week's calendar. That's the day the U.S. government officially runs out of money and hits the debt ceiling, moving the U.S. closer to default. Talks over the weekend fell apart. Hopes for a deal shift to the Senate now. Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell have taken the lead. Even if they make a deal, though, the House has to sign on, and that's no easy get. This hour on Point, the most plugged-in Washington reporters on where things stand right now. You can join us on air or online. Are you worried about a default? Are you one of the 60% of Americans who wants to throw all the lawmakers out? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. As I said, we have a great panel joining us from Washington today. Michael Hirsch, chief correspondent for National Journal. Michael, welcome back to On Point.
Oh, happy to be here.
Susan Davis, congressional correspondent for USA Today. Susan, welcome back to you as well.
Hey, Jane.
And Charles Babington, political and congressional reporter for the Associated Press. Chuck, always good to have you. Thanks.
Well, thanks for having me, Jane.
Susan Davis, I'll start with you. Help us understand what transpired over the weekend as we go to air right now. Where do we stand?
Well, the short of it is nothing happened over the weekend.
Yes.
I think there's been a lot of talk and a lot of partisan fighting, but we are not really any closer to resolving either the government shutdown or the impending default on October 17th. We did see, in terms of negotiations, we did see sort of the power shift away from House Republicans, who in many ways started this to begin with the government shutdown at the end of September in their effort to dismantle the health care law. Obviously, that has rolled into this larger debate about the debt ceiling. But because President Obama does not seem more inclined to deal with House Republicans, nor have House Republicans proven that they have the votes to pass anything, that the momentum has now shifted into the Senate, where the Majority Leader Harry Reid and the Minority Leader Mitch McConnell are working together to see if they can come up with a plan that could potentially get at least 60 votes in the Senate to pass and go back to the House. But it's a very volatile situation, and it's not entirely clear if they're going to be able to make this deadline by Thursday.
As you say, this is all shifted to the Senate. Here's some sound. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, Democrat from Nevada, said he is still talking with Senate Minority Leader, Republican from Kentucky, Mitch McConnell. Here is Harry Reid.
I've had a productive conversation with the Republican leader this afternoon. Our discussions were substantive, and we'll continue those discussions. I'm optimistic about the prospects for a positive conclusion to the issues before this country today.
Chuck Babington, where do negotiations between Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell stand?
Well, they've got a number of things in front of them, Jane. And as Susan was saying, it was almost inevitable that this would have to shift to the Senate because the Senate is a much more balanced body. The Democrats have the majority, but they don't have a filibuster-proof majority. So it's the type of place where you're much more likely to have to work something out, unlike the Republican-controlled House where the rules are different. And, of course, the Democrats have the White House, too. So it makes kind of more sense that things would end up in the Senate. At first, McConnell, the Republicans are in a position of having to retreat a bit trench by trench. It's a question of how much they retreat. The changing Obamacare is pretty much out of the picture now. And now Susan Collins, a moderate Republican senator from Maine, had sort of a compromise deal in mind that would make some modest changes in the funding of Obamacare, that sort of thing. And McConnell said he could go with that. But even now, Harry Reid, the Democratic leader, is saying no deal on that. So I think we've got a lot of negotiations yet to go. I don't think we know where they're going to end up yet.
Here is Republican Senator from Maine, Susan Collins. She said she was confused by Harry Reid's rejection of her debt ceiling deal, but she says she is still hopeful.
I'm still hopeful that at least we sparked a dialogue that did not exist before we put out a plan. And I think that I've made a real contribution that way, and that elements of the plan that Senator Murkowski and Senator Ayotte and I have put forth will end up in the final compromise.
Michael Hirsch, what were the sticking points on the Collins plan?
Well, what's happened here basically is the Republicans have gone from being on the offensive where they were trying to defund or delay Obamacare in the House to being on the defensive here, because suddenly Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, has raised the issue of the sequester, which was put in place under the Budget Control Act a couple of years ago. Was, you may remember, a titanic fight back then. A second round of sequester cuts are coming into play here. And what Collins' compromise proposal did, and what I think the real sticking point there, is that she extended the issue of spending out to March, in which case next year's the 2014 sequester cuts would begin to would come into play, and the Democrats don't want that. They want to renegotiate the sequester to reduce the impact of it. So that's a non-starter. And what you have here is Harry Reid basically saying, you know, we simply are not going to negotiate. Under threat of, you know, the debt ceiling breach, and while the government is shut down. And what you was seen is this remarkable solid front between the White House, President Obama, and Harry Reid on this issue. And that's why the Republicans are on the run right now.
I want to hear from Ted Cruz, Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz, because he spoke in Washington on Friday at the Value Voters Summit. He continued to speak out against Obamacare.
I'm going to suggest a model for how we turn this country around in the next couple of years. And it is the model that we have been following together for the last couple of months to stop that train wreck, that disaster, that nightmare that is Obamacare.
Susan Davis, you continue to hear that Obamacare essentially now is off the table in this conversation, but the conversation has shifted quite a bit, has it not? It's evolved. First, it was about defunding Obamacare, then delaying it for a year. Now the talk is all about entitlement reform and spending. Explain that shift a little more in focus.
Well, and what's interesting about it is I think in the negotiations we're in right now, I think most people can agree that a fundamental change to the healthcare law is not going to be a part of the final product. There's some reforms to the law that even the president has said he's been open to, but not in the context of holding a default as a threat. What is interesting and what makes complexities to these negotiations, particularly in the House, is there is still a significant block of Republicans, Ted Cruz is among them, who we know are going to be no's at the end of the day because they have pledged to not vote for anything that does not significantly dismantle the law. And this is part of the sort of political squeeze that John Boehner has found himself in that John Boehner knows that he's not going to be able to defund or delay the healthcare law. But he also has a very significant, very full, powerful block of conservative Republicans that he is also trying to manage to get them to vote enough votes on board at the end of the day. In the Senate, you have Ted Cruz, who has sort of become the national figure of this, who I think is also trying using going sort of across the chambers and encouraging this sort of rebellion against the party's own leadership. So even beyond the sort of bipartisan negotiation we see now with Reid and McConnell trying to find a way out of this, there is this sort of secondary story of this tremendous turmoil within the Republican Party over the healthcare law and whether the party has enough unity within it to stick together to have any kind of leverage coming to you know get be able to claim any kind of win in whatever comes out of this.
Chuck Babington, talk a little bit more about that political dynamic that's going on between House Republicans and Senate Republicans on this issue.
Well, Republicans in trying to defund or delay Obamacare were bargaining from a position of weakness from the very beginning. It was never plausible that President Barack Obama was going to allow Obamacare to be, you know, stopped in some way. Remember, he ran for re-election and he won re-election, you know, long after this was passed. So this was a frustration to a lot of Republicans who said, you know, we started this battle that we couldn't possibly win. We're going to be talking a lot about Ted Cruz in the next 4 or 5 years, but I think he is not a key player in the debate now that we're talking about how to get the government funded and how to get past the debt ceiling. That issue has moved past him. Again, as Susan was suggesting, the real tough part is going to become, you know, once whatever the Senate agrees to, they'll probably agree to something. Then it's got to go to the House. And there's quite a few, probably 30, 40, 50, maybe more Republicans who are not going to vote for anything that the Senate would approve. And that puts John Boehner in a tough spot because then he has to get quite a number of Democratic votes. And he's going to have to make a hard decision at some point. And it's quite possible that he would have to decide whether to put something on the floor that not even most of his Republicans would vote for. And that's a position that a speaker never wants to be in, that he's dealing with the minority of his own caucus. So that's going to be the tough spot. But really, the House is in a position now of sort of having to watch and wait to see what the Senate comes up with.
So, Michael Hirsch, it doesn't sound good. To your mind, is there any plan in play that could get through both houses of Congress and be signed by the president?
Not currently. And that's, you know, the really grave danger here. It's not just a question of the Senate leaders being at loggerheads here. It's that almost any plan, including the Susan Collins compromise we discussed in the Senate, would probably be a non-starter in this House, which is much more far right. And this is, you know, we're running out of time. There are 3 days left until the Treasury Department basically runs out of cash, and the debt ceiling would need to be raised. And so, you know, we're in this strange calculus where are there going to be enough hours, you know, the next 72 hours to get done what needs to be done? There clearly is going to have to be some kind of a compromise. Clearly, the Democrats, Harry Reid and President Obama, are going to have to give a little bit in terms of allowing the Republicans a face-saving way out, perhaps by setting up some sort of negotiating mechanism, which the Senate Democrats are open to. The big question is, even if there is an agreement over the next, say, day or so on that, will the House approve it?
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. 3 days before the U.S. government will hit the debt ceiling and risk defaulting, we're looking at where we stand. We're speaking this hour with Michael Hirsch, chief correspondent for National Journal, Susan Davis, congressional correspondent for USA Today, and Chuck Babington, politics and congressional reporter for the Associated Press. A little more sound here at the top. Yesterday, Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, said that the Tea Party and Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz have been hurt by the government shutdown and the debt ceiling impasse.
The Tea Party has reached its peak. I think Ted Cruz, early on in his career, has reached his peak. This idea that I am going to cause huge damage to you and to America unless I completely get my way, once the spotlight shines on it, doesn't look very good. And the spotlight is now shown on it. And so you've seen the numbers. Tea Party numbers are way down. But even the Republican Party, which has followed the Tea Party by and large over the last year or two, are way down.
And then yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation, conservative Congressman Tim Holzkamp, Republican from Kansas, said he is still urging his Republican colleagues to stand firm on defunding Obamacare. He also said that he does not believe that the government will default on Thursday.
There will be no default. It's not going to happen. There are no payments due on October 17th to pay our creditors. There are no payments due until November 15th. I think clearly the White House is trying to scare the markets. I think that's unfortunate. But at the end of the day, the reality is October 17th is a date that will not have a major impact unless the White House is able to create concern about that.
Mm. So this is a point, Susan Davis, that Tea Party Republicans keep making, basically that the debt ceiling is not real. Is there any truth to that?
No. There is a point that there is a certain amount of Republicans in Congress that are certainly default deniers that say that the results of it would not be as bad as people threaten. Part of that is because we've never defaulted before. So it's hard to say what would happen because it would be a rather unprecedented economic event. I do think that there is part of what they are saying is that the schedule of payments by which come out of the Treasury would not all immediately happen on October 17th. There are more crunch deadlines. October 31st, interest payments have to go out in the early November. Social Security and Medicare payments have to go out. It would really be a default over a couple of weeks. It's not really a hard and fast deadline. So to the extent that on October 17th, the entire U.S. economy doesn't default, that is true. But I think the much more mainstream, much more prevalent economical view is that defaulting is bad, and that even the threat of it, the previous default debt ceiling fight that we had in 2011, estimated to cost the economy just $20 billion alone just in changing interest rates and market moving because of the threat of default. So if we were to actually go over,
like I said, we don't know exactly what would happen, but the U.S. Treasury is sort of the gold standard of the global credit market. And if we begin to call that into question, it seems reasonable to think that it could have negative impacts on not only our own financial market, but sort of the global markets as well.
Chuck Babington, continue on that point and help us understand what happens for the average person who wakes up on Thursday morning and there just is no deal.
Well, Jane, it's hard to know. A lot would depend on what happens in the markets all over the world. As Sue was pointing out, you can quibble with the details of what might happen on Thursday and Friday if there's no deal on the debt ceiling. But the point is, some of the Republicans say, we wouldn't default on our sovereign debt because they could prioritize the payments of the bills that we have. Well, the point is that the world of finance operates on faith and trust. And once, you lose your faith and trust that the United States is going to pay all its obligations, the damage has probably been done. And that's what I think, the really smart economists around the country are saying. So we haven't been here. We came close to defaulting in 2011. Even getting that close did, result in a first-time downgrading of the creditworthiness of the nation, and that cost us some money there. This would be much worse. Especially in the Senate, the vast majority of Republican senators as well as the Democrats think that this is not a good idea. It has to be avoided. They just haven't figured out how to put the pieces together yet.
Yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press, International Monetary Fund Managing Director Christine Lagarde said that at the IMF's annual meeting in Washington, D.C. this weekend, everybody agreed that there was a risk of recession if the U.S. defaulted on its debt.
One thing was certain around the table. It was that if there is that degree of disruption, that lack of certainty, that lack of trust in the U.S. signature, it would mean massive disruption the world over, and we would be at risk of tipping yet again into recession.
Michael Hirsch, how is the international community reacting to the risk of default?
With a great deal of fear and criticism. You've had the Chinese government, through its official news service, call for the de-Americanization of the world, an alternative to the dollar. All of this fear and turmoil in the markets, although it's just starting now, is bound to make things more expensive for America and Americans in the future. There's, virtually no disagreement among economists on that. There was a report by Citigroup Research that showed that we could shoot back up to 10% unemployment, and as Lagarde warned, another recession if this is not resolved. So you what you have is the chief stabilizing power in the world, the only superpower, in a state of total political paralysis, and that's not surprisingly already begun to panic markets around the world. I think what's most notable about this standoff is that there is a very substantial minority not a majority of Republicans, but a very substantial and decisive minority that, as Susan suggested, are simply default deniers. It's like being a climate science denier. You simply are not paying attention to the facts. And they could still prove decisive in sending the country into its first ever default.
Because, Susan Davis, aren't there many other lending partners that countries can rely on? I mean, do you foresee other countries turning to places like China and not the U.S. After this spectacle in Washington?
The honest answer is I don't know, and I don't think we really know how other countries will respond. I do think at this point, and we haven't seen much market fluctuation even today, is that because we've done this before, because Washington has done this at least on two other occasions in the past 3 years, there's a certain amount of confidence in the market that they're going to resolve it before Thursday. Maybe it's Wednesday night at midnight, maybe it's, the 11th hour, but this is what happens and this is when it gets done. So I think part of what is also encouraging congressmen like Tim Huell's camp is that they're looking at the markets and they're seeing not a lot of volatility and they're saying, see, if this was so bad that we would see a lot more upheaval. I do think it's important to remember also in the context of all of this that the United States is the only country in the world that has this debt limit mechanism that allows the Congress to have a separate vote to allow for more borrowing
to pay for the spending that it has already approved. It's important and worth restating that the debt limit does not allow for more spending. It allows to borrow the money to pay for the obligations that the Congress, that is constitutionally charged with spending the money, has already done. So it's to say it's irresponsible is probably an understatement. And I think that there's a sort of disbelief is what we've heard, particularly with the IMF meetings and foreign leaders that are and the World Bank leader, that this can't be happening. It's almost sort of surreal to other countries that we're going down this path.
And Chuck Babington, what do you make of the market, the lack of market fluctuation? I mean, do the markets have a voice in this in bringing about a compromise? And sort of how do you see that?
They certainly could have a voice, Jane. Remember back in late 2008 when the recession was really, things were really falling apart. It was a very serious time, and there was a big vote, the bank bailout vote, the so-called TARP vote, and the Senate had passed it, and the House surprised people by voting against it, voting to kill it. And that day, the Dow dropped like 775 points. It was quite a shock. 3 days later, the House came and passed the TARP bill. So you could see something. If we do go into default, even for a day, it would be a very bad thing. I do think the markets would probably react so dramatically, maybe more dramatically than that day in 2008, that there's a strong possibility that the Congress would have to do something different. I'd certainly be surprised if we went into default and it lasted like the partial government shutdown is, which is a much, much less consequential event.
Mm. Got to get some listeners in here. We've got calls lined up around the block. Kathleen is first up in Cheshire, Connecticut. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome to On Point.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is this. Is there some mechanism to do an emergency recall of these intransigent Republican senators in their own states? Or are the states so gerrymandered that no matter what, the will of the people in those states would be thwarted by these individuals who are so ignorant and have such a vendetta against Obama and the Democrats that they're refusing to negotiate? They've caused total dysfunction in this country, and I'm livid. I think that Obama and his Democrats are absolutely 100% right in not negotiating, but I can't believe that there's not a way to recall these individuals, have gubernatorial appointments to fill their House seats, and at least maybe the threat of that would make these individuals turn around and walk in a more peaceful negotiating.
All right, Kathleen, let's take that to Susan Davis. I appreciate your call. Thanks. Susan.
The short answer is no. There is no mechanism, particularly in the House, to get any lawmaker out of office, which is why the entire House is up for re-election every 2 years. I think the best way that you can get House lawmakers out of office is you have to vote them out of office. The caller does hit on a point, though, in that the way that the lines are drawn in the House, that we have created a much more polarized Congress. We live in a reality where Democrats tend to be much more liberal and Republicans tend to be much more conservative. And the sort of centrist middle is all pretty much but evaporated, and that in a lot of districts, Republicans' biggest electoral threat is a primary election, that they will be challenged within the party versus a general election. So it does create more entrenched partisanship in the Congress. That is for certain.
I want to bring up some interesting poll numbers out this weekend. The NBC Wall Street Journal poll shows the Republican Party taking the brunt of the blame for this. 53% blame the Republicans. The view of the Republican Party, 24% positive right now. That's the lowest ever recorded by these pollsters, at least. Only 14% of the country thinks we're going in the right direction. 60% of the country would replace every single member of Congress. Michael Hirsch, everyone's falling, but Republicans seem to be taking a bigger hit here.
Yeah, all the polling has showed that over the last week or so. But it's important to remember there is this substantial and determinative minority, the Tea Party faction in the House of Representatives, that simply does not seem to care. And getting back to the earlier caller's point, these districts are so red, Republican red, as it were, that the main concern that many of these House members have is that they'll get a primary challenge from the right. And so there's, you know, there's a substantial portion of the House representatives who represent these districts who I think to some degree are actually enjoying this. I mean, you can remember we've had this very strong libertarian strain rising in American politics that's part of the Tea Party movement that, you know, their fantasy world is a world without government or very limited government. And that's, in effect, what they're getting now. I think they are denying the impact of a default because it's never happened before. And many of them are not, you know, particularly up to speed on international finance. And so, you know, in some ways, they're inhabiting a different planet, as it were. They're really not in tune with the reality. They know they're not going to pay at the polls if they continue this standoff. And that's what, in the end, the president of the United States is going to have to worry about. You know, he's making a good show of taking a stand here. But as Susan suggested earlier, over the next 3 days, I think there's going to have to be some effort at a compromise. I think this is going to move back to the House, and perhaps in negotiations between Obama and the House might start up again.
I want to play a little more sound yesterday on ABC's This Week, where Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina called the Republican House push to tie an Obamacare delay to the federal budget, he called it unrealistic. And he said that the ongoing gridlock is hurting both parties.
We're in a free fall as Republicans, but Democrats are not far behind. And after listening to all of us talk, now I probably understand why 60% of Americans want to vote all incumbents out. To my colleagues in the House on both sides and to my friends in the Senate, we're ruining both institutions.
Ruining both institutions. Chuck Babington, how do you see this? You hear the disgust and the anger in people across this country.
Yeah, one thing to keep in mind, Jane, you talked about these poll numbers. Senator Graham was just talking about the damage to both parties. In the House, every member of the House represents roughly 435th of the nation. And he or she, all members, nearly all members, care very much about being reelected. They know their district well. And especially with the Republicans now, they're more important because they control the House. When people talk about the Republican Party as being damaged, in many ways, when I talk with these House members, that's almost a meaningless term. Sure, they're Republicans, but what they care about is their district and particularly their next primary because that's where they're in danger. They'll never lose a general election to a Democrat in their district because it's been drawn to be so conservative. And so they worry about an insurgent from the right possibly beating them in a Tea Party type of primary. So when you talk about the Republican Party being damaged or even the Republicans having a difficult time winning presidential election, these guys are like, well, you know, I'm not running for president and I'm not running the Republican Party. I'm running in my district in November 2014 and the primary is in September and here's the guy that I worry about running against me. And that's their reality. And so you've got to be careful when you talk about these big picture, sort of national trends, because in many ways, a lot of House members do not care about these national polls. They're meaningless to them because the only poll that matters is the poll in their district.
Mm. Let me squeeze in a call here before our next break. Doug is in Platteville, Wisconsin. Hi, Doug. Glad you called. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm.
I've listened to a lot of this, and ultimately, yeah, the American people are extremely angry about the situation that's going on. But a lot of us aren't angry about, oh, do we raise the debt ceiling or not? The question is, if we're broke, like when I get broke, I don't have any extra money to spend. I can't go borrow money to spend. It's called foolish and fiscally irresponsible. How do we figure out, or, well, we know what the problem is. How do we fix the problem? If the Federal Reserve Bank loans us money and attaches debt to it perpetually, and we can never pay off that debt, all we do is continuously end up further in debt.
Doug, thank you. I'm going to cut in here and get Susan Davis before we go to our break. Susan, quickly.
I think the caller makes a really good point. I mean, there is sort of a substantive argument here beyond the politics of what we're talking about that we do have a debt problem. And I don't think anybody on Capitol Hill would say otherwise. But in the context of using a default or shutting down the government to accomplish those, I think that that is where the divide over the means to the end, if not the end, is where we see the fight.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the government shutdown and the debt ceiling impasse. We're speaking this hour with Michael Hirsch, chief correspondent for National Journal, Susan Davis, congressional correspondent for USA Today, and Chuck Babington, politics and congressional reporter for the Associated Press. Here's more sound. Yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press, Senator Rob Portman, Republican from Ohio, said that the U.S. has been overspending for decades.
This is an opportunity over the next couple days, but really over the next couple months, because I think we'll probably push this down the road a little bit, to deal with the underlying problem. And that is the fact that we have these historic levels of debt and deficit that are hurting the economy today. It's like a wet blanket on the economy today. That's why we're not, in my view, getting the kind of robust recovery we all hope for.
Michael Hirsch, Senator Portman seems to be hinting that he's hopeful that there will be some sort of grand bargain here. Is there hope for that?
No, I mean, I don't think there's going to be a grand bargain whereby, you know, all of these spending issues, including the sequester and the need to, combine revenue increases, which is what the Democrats want, with spending cuts, all to happen before the debt ceiling, is breached. I don't think that's going to happen. What is possible, it seems to me, the only thing that's practical is for the White House and the Democrats in the Senate to agree to some kind of a negotiating mechanism, which is what John Boehner initially tried to do last Thursday when he came up with his first offer, essentially to extend the debt ceiling for 6 weeks. He left aside the government shutdown, hoping to use that as leverage, and then, demanded that the White House begin budget negotiations. Obama said no. He has been trying to stick to principles here, saying that I am simply not going to negotiate any of these issues, which I'm happy to do at any normal time, while you're holding, the government and the national debt hostage. I mean, that's been the consistent position of both President Obama and Harry Reid. And the question really, I think, is are they going to just continue that right up until Thursday when the debt ceiling deadline is hit? And I think there will be some kind of a deal. That's what markets are suggesting right now.
Let's get a call in here. Rob is in Claremont, New Hampshire. Welcome to the program, Rob. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. The reason I wanted to call is I've heard a lot about the intransigence of the Republicans. But I also wonder whether Harry Reid has also been intransigent in terms of obstructing the negotiations which need to take place. In the run-up to the continuing resolution, he encouraged the president not to negotiate. And now, with the disarray that the Republicans are in, he's shifting the goalposts on the continuing resolution to make it more encompassing and to roll back the sequester, which would have been a part of any normal continuing resolution. So I'm wondering if the intransigence on the part of Harry Reid and his encouragement of the president not to negotiate has contributed to the deadlock which we are in.
It's a good point, Rob. I appreciate you calling. Susan Davis, would you respond?
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly say that Harry Reid is not above playing politics in all of this. I think he has seen an opportunity to really drive the divide within the Republican Party, to put their backs up against the wall on this. And I do think that he's shown a remarkable ability in this round of talks to keep President Obama on the same talking points and in the same unity. I think we've seen prior, particularly in the fiscal cliff, if we recall that the last showdown we had in Washington over the budget, that during that negotiation, Harry Reid was in a similar place where he was driving a very hard bargain and trying to be the tough negotiator. And Barack Obama essentially directed Joe Biden to go around Harry Reid and cut the deal with Mitch McConnell. And Harry Reid was cut out of the last deal. And in this one, Harry Reid is really driving sort of the terms of the negotiations. On a substantive point, I do think that the president feels very strongly that if he is capable of putting an end to the kind of brinksmanship we've seen, particularly on the debt ceiling, I think there's less of a broader economic concern about the shutdown, although it's very inconvenient and affecting a lot of people. But that if there is some way that they can use this negotiation to stop the usage of the debt limit
as a brinksmanship tool, then I think that Democrats will think that that was a big victory and worth the fight.
Here's a question from one of our Facebook listeners who says, I need a civics lesson. What is the structure or process in the House of Representatives that gives Speaker Boehner the sole power to bring a resolution to a vote? Is there nothing in the House rules that allows any representative to put a proposition on the agenda and then the members simply vote? Chuck Babington.
No, there's not. The House rules are much more strict than the Senate rules, and there's no way that one member can force a vote on anything. The minority party can, through complicated means, try to force something to the floor, but it's very, very difficult because the rules are written such that the majority party really, really has power, Jane. And if I could just return briefly to one thing we were talking about earlier with both Senator Portman and Doug, your caller Doug, about why do we constantly have these debts. We can't completely let the American voter and the American public off the hook here, because as a people, we generally demand a high level of services and a low level of taxation. And that's what we've had for years. And then we turn around and say, we also don't want a deficit. Well, you can't have all three of those things. And so, it's really within the ability of Congress every single day to have a balanced budget. You just don't appropriate more money than you're willing to bring in through fees and taxation. And that's what we've not done. So, you get this kind of whole mess with the debt ceiling and these grand bargain negotiations. The grand bargain negotiations wouldn't be necessary, if we lived within our means. But you can't just hang that entirely on the elected officials. The American people have to support something that is, if that's what they want, if they want a balanced budget, then they've got to support the level of taxation and the level of services to make that happen.
What about John Boehner's speakership? Is it in trouble in the House? He's under tremendous pressure from Tea Party members. Will his speakership be in trouble if he accepts a Senate deal? Susan Davis?
Potentially, yes. I mean, I think that's certainly one of the underrunning dramas of this entire debate is, can the Boehner speakership survive this? I think in the short term, yes. In short, because it's really hard take out a sitting speaker. But I certainly think it's a very valuable question to say, is there long-term repercussions for him in this? And can he return as speaker in the next Congress, I think, is probably the trickier political question. But absolutely, I think the way he has handled these negotiations and the outcome and what it does for the Republican Party is all going to be sort of measured as seen as either a success or failure for John Boehner. And that's going to be really tough. But we don't really know in the short term if it's how deeply it could undermine him as the speaker.
Michael Hirsch, what's your take?
I agree with what was just said. I think a lot of this is going to come down to Boehner, his political viability. He's going to have to make a decision in the next few days about whether, as reported earlier, he's intent on not letting the debt ceiling be breached no matter what, and will call a vote because, as Chuck said, he's the one who does have the power to call a vote. As the Democrats have been saying for, almost a couple of weeks now, if you held a vote today on the debt ceiling, you would probably get enough Democrats and moderate Republicans to approve extending the debt ceiling. But Boehner has not wanted to call that because that could be a fatal blow to his speakership if he's seen as dealing with, Democrats and not a majority of Republicans. And so the question is going to come down to Boehner in the end. Is he going to be willing to call that vote, prevent a potential catastrophe for the U.S. economy and the world, and possibly, be willing to sacrifice his speakership for that? Or is he going to hold out?
Here's some sound from Senator Dick Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois. He's speaking to David Gregory on NBC's Meet the Press. This was yesterday. He said that a U.S. debt default will affect retirement and savings accounts for average Americans.
I hope sensible people prevail, because at this point, it isn't just a shutdown and all of the damage that's caused. But if we default on our debt, it will have a dramatic negative impact on the savings account and retirement account.
And then on Saturday, in his weekly address, President Obama said that a U.S. debt default would hurt everyday Americans.
Damage to America's sterling credit rating wouldn't just cause global markets to go haywire. It would become more expensive for everyone in America to borrow money. Students paying for college, newlyweds buying a home. It would amount to a new tax, a Republican default tax on every family and business in America.
So it's not just a possible government default, but the government is still shut down, let us not forget. And I'm curious to hear what our panelists think about the ripple effect of this, beyond federal employees who are obviously suffering now in the third week of this shutdown. Timing isn't so good heading into the holiday season. You know, how do you see this trickle-down sort of effect? What's the ripple effect for the average American? Chuck Babington?
You're starting to hear, Jane, more and more stories from across the country about, you know, ordinary Americans, not government workers, being affected for all kinds of reasons. People who lead fish and wildlife tours can't do the tours because the reservation, the areas that they would go into are shut down. There's all kinds of government regulations and checks that need to be done on various products before they can move, and a lot of those have been shut down. You know, at first, I think the Republicans felt that from a political standpoint, the government was in such a partial shutdown. Let's keep in mind, this is not a government shutdown. You know, from the very beginning, Social Security, Medicare, the mail, the military, all those things kept functioning. Yeah. You know, most workers, many workers are on the job. But in these areas that are shut down, I think for a while the Republicans felt that it was a politically winning position, because a lot of their constituents don't really like government anyway, or say that they don't. But now, over time, I think they've seen that it's not such a great position, because there are just more and more stories trickling in from all over the country about how this affects so many people in so many ways, and then the dominoes just keep falling.
Here is Sam on the line now from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam. Welcome to On Point.
Hey, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Do we have a minute just to reflect on the stupidity of having to vote on raising the debt limit? I mean, I thought the whole idea was Congress votes to approve spending, and then they have to vote again because no one's been keeping track of the final tally. Can't they just have an electronic scoreboard in the House and the Senate that just reminds them how much they spent, so that we don't have to keep doing this stupid thing? Or what would it take to just get rid of this vote, not do this anymore?
Susan Davis, speak to Sam's question. Why can't we just get rid of the debt ceiling?
We could. I mean, Congress could say we don't need to do this anymore. We give the authority, or just presume that the money we spend, the money that we authorize to spend, we will allow the borrowing to pay for it. The reality is Congress is very unlikely to cede any authority it currently has to the executive branch, and certainly not in a divided Congress ceding any more authority to Barack Obama. The president has asked for this. He said this in his most recent budget. He said, give me the responsibility. I'll take the blame for it. You know, if we need somebody to say it's my decision to raise the debt ceiling, I'll make that decision. I don't see Congress giving that authority away. There is one sort of workaround around this, which was devised by Mitch McConnell, who's the Republican minority leader, in which the last time we had a big debt limit fight, he created a mechanism by which the debt ceiling would get raised unless both chambers of Congress passed a resolution of disapproval saying that they didn't support the raising of it. It's sort of a legislative semantic, but it was a way of basically ensuring that both the debt ceiling would get raised and members of Congress could go on record voicing disapproval but not threatening default. I think it's possible that something along those lines could come out of these negotiations, either in the short or long term. But if the short answer is Congress could get rid of it if they wanted to.
Michael Hirsch, we're running out of time here, but I want you to speak for just a minute about the personal hostility that's been part of these negotiations between politicians. I mean, it's not just Republicans versus Democrats. It's Senate versus House. I mean, this has gotten really personal among a lot of people, has it not?
Oh, it definitely has. I mean, you have various levels of hostility, obviously, between the Tea Party base and Obama over Obamacare, over his very presidency. A lot of this dates back to the beginning of Obama's presidency when he piled the TARP plan, which, remember, began under George W. Bush. A lot of this began under the previous Republican administration, with which many of these extreme right-wing conservatives were unhappy also. But then the stimulus, then the health care plan. So there's deep-seated mistrust and anger, and you have personal enmity between Boehner and Obama. I mean, Boehner said, a year ago that he was no longer going to negotiate with Obama after the fiscal cliff talks, and then, of course, he came back and did anyway. Between Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell, you have a lot of personal enmity. There were words flying between them when they had the negotiations over the filibuster rules not that long ago, with McConnell saying, saying that Harry Reid was the first, you know, worst Senate leader ever. So I think that is one factor here in holding things up for so long.
Have we reached a new level, Chuck Babington? The level of mistrust, the level of anger among these politicians, is this something new? Is this just, you know, par for the course in Congress?
Well, every time I find myself about to write something like unprecedented hostility, I remember that we did have a civil war and some pretty horrible things happening then. But in the modern era, it is bad. The level of hostility is very, very damaging. I will say this. I wouldn't put too much emphasis on the personal aspect of it. Yes, it would be better if these people got along. But the notion that if, you know, President Obama were to have conservative House members over to the White House for tea or coffee or beer or something, that they would say, gee, you know, he's a nice guy, I think I'll vote with him. No, that's not very likely to happen. The animosities really grow out of ideology, and they reflect the very strong splits within the country, the strong partisan splits and intensity in this country. And that's really the problem. So I think a lot of this animosity is ideologically driven. That doesn't mean it's not a problem. It is a problem.
So, Susan Davis, in our last minute, I'll give you the last word as we are on air now. What's next? Where do we go from here?
Well, I think the next 72 hours are going to be very critical. I think that a default is possible. I don't think it's – I think having watched the negotiations over the weekend and hearing – talking to people on Capitol Hill, I don't get a lot of certainty coming from leaders that they are ultimately confident that this is going to be resolved by Thursday. So it's going to be a really dramatic week in Washington. That's the long and short of it.
Well, many thanks to a really terrific panel and the excellent information you brought to us today. Susan Davis, congressional correspondent for USA Today. Susan, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jane.
Michael Hirsch, chief correspondent for National Journal. Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
And Chuck Babington, politics and congressional reporter for the Associated Press. Chuck, thanks as always.
Thanks, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.